in various operations in third world nations around the globe. No, in conclusion, I can't say that America is a peaceful nation. The US must learn that without justice in the world, there can never be peace. And with continued injustice, we must learn that resistance is the only answer. And resistance takes many, many different levels, from writing to the local paper. Now, I don't know what you've done today. I have sent 40 letters. I didn't realise there were so many media outlets in New Zealand. I have sent 40 letters out complaining about Winston Peters. And I should know his name by heart now. I've typed it that many times. Even if just one of those letters gets published, or one reference is made to from the letter, it will have been worth it. I want you all to adopt a zero tolerance to people like Winston Peters. I want you to adopt a zero tolerance whenever you hear George Bush and you don't like what he says, which will probably be every single day for the rest of his presidency, to send a letter in to the newspapers or to ring a radio phone-in program. Don't just do it for yourselves. Do it for your brothers and sisters who have been tortured in Abu Ghraib, in Guantanamo Bay, in Belmarsh in London. I got a phone call today from a Muslim friend in Britain, and he said the Muslim community in Britain is in crisis. It's under attack. People are waiting for the door to come crashing in at 3-4 in the morning. People are nervous. If you're going to write that letter, do it with them in thought. There are many brothers and sisters around the world that need your help, and you can do it in so many different ways. Go on to the Boycott Israeli Goods website. Drinking a bottle of Coca-Cola is like drinking the blood of Palestinian women and children. You may as well hand over the bullets direct to the Israeli army to shoot them in the back. Stop supporting Zionist goods. Educate your children. Get your children to go onto the website. Let them know about why they should be boycotting certain goods. Every time I see a Starbucks, and you've got them in New Zealand, I could scream. The chief executive of Starbucks was so happy, so proud of what the Israeli army did in Jenin. He took 100 soldiers and their families and gave them free holidays in Disneyland. Do not patronize Starbucks. As I say, when you buy from Zionist operators like that and Marks and Spencers, you may as well go straight up to the Israeli army and give them bullets to shoot our brothers and sisters in the back. Stop doing it. Boycotting something can be a really powerful thing to do if we do it collectively. And there'll be cynics here saying, well, what can one person do? It only takes one snowflake to cause an avalanche. You could be that snowflake. So please don't underestimate your own power individually, and certainly don't underestimate your own power collectively. And finally, I want to finish off on a happy note, because it's, you know, this is a great occasion. Reverts coming together in New Zealand. And so we should finish off on a high note. And I want to share with you a very moving experience that happened to me in January. I was able to perform Hajj. I never dreamed that I would have such a gift come to me so early on as a new Muslim revert, but I went to Mecca. And when I got back, a few brothers and sisters said to me, what was the most moving, emotional moment for you? Was it seeing the Kaaba for the first time? Was it going into Mecca? Did you go to Medina? Did you see the tomb of the Prophet, peace be upon him? What was the most moving moment? And I said, it came unexpectedly. One day, I was late for prayer. And I'd heard the azan, and I'm rushing round, and I picked up my prayer mat, and I ran out of the hotel, down some cobbled streets, down some winding steps, right round into the main thoroughfare, almost breathless, trying to get to the mosque on time. And there in front of me were 10,000 and more other Muslims, all late for prayer. And we were all pushing and shoving and jostling, many different languages, nationalities, cultures, skin colors, it was just a whole cocktail of chaos as we were trying to get to the mosque, and we had no chance. And then the prayer started. And I put down my prayer mat on the road, and I looked up, and there was a straight line. And in front of me, there were rows and rows and rows of Muslims standing, ready for prayer. And I looked, and I thought, I don't understand the person standing next to me, and the person to my left cannot understand me. But we all knew what we had to do. And we stood there, disciplined. Out of the chaos came this discipline. And I just looked, and the tears started coming down my face, and I thought, this is my family, this is my new family. Look how disciplined we are. Allah's army, look at us, standing to attention. There isn't a single army in the world that could have stood to attention that quickly out of the chaotic scene seconds earlier. And the tears just came down, and I thought, there's tens of thousands of us here doing this, praying in the streets, on the footpath, immaculate lines. And there are millions more around the world doing the same thing. We can be so united. We can be so strong. And if we can do this 5 times a day, why can't we do this 24/7? Because if we did this 24/7, if we were this united and this disciplined, people would respect us. They wouldn't dare invade our lands. They wouldn't dare abuse our brothers and sisters and lock them up and persecute them and rape them and sodomize them. They wouldn't dare pick up our Quran and defile it. If we could be this united 24/7, the world would sit up and take notice, and they would back off. Because as I said before, if they hurt one of us, they hurt all of us. And if we are that strong and that united, they wouldn't dare harm a hair on our head. And I just wanted to leave you with that really uplifting thought. And I know that a joke was made earlier on about the lateness of Muslims, and we should try and be more punctual. But I want to leave you also with one thought. The early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum, sister.
Walaikum salam.
From your media background, do you think that there's an agenda internationally to tarnish the image of Islam?
Sometimes I think that the rubbish that's written about Muslims and Islam is part of an agenda, is part of an Islamophobic drive. Other times, I think that it is down to pure ignorance of the journalist writing the story. And this is when it's the latter, This is where we come in by sending in letters, because if journalists have made fools of themselves, they won't want to repeat the mistake again. And also, if it is an Islamophobic drive and there is a lot of mail coming in, then it will also send out a clear signal that we're not going to tolerate such rubbish either. But it's interesting. For instance, I have noticed the demonization process starting on two different sections of our society in the last 2 or 3 weeks. One is of the Pakistan community, and I'm not quite sure why. I haven't quite got the full picture yet. But as you know, the identities of the so-called London bombers the other week, the majority were British-born Asians. And as a result of that revelation, 200 Pakistanis were rounded up and arrested in tear gas operations on madrasas, which left young schoolgirls in tears and in fear. But 200 Pakistanis were rounded up in Pakistan and locked up. Then there was the Egyptian bombings, and again, the Egyptian authorities were saying, oh, Pakistanis were behind this. And you know, you begin to learn the signs and recognize the signs of the demonization process, and I'm not quite sure why that is. I'm sure it will unfold in the next few weeks. And the other demonization process was targeted at a non-violent political group which has organizations throughout the world called Hizb ut-Tahrir. I'm not a follower or supporter of HT as they are known in Britain. However, I can put my hand on my heart and say that this is a non-violent, politically motivated group which wants to the return of the caliphate, and they want to bring about that change by political thought, certainly not actions. And yet, if you watch over the coming weeks, you will see this group being singled out and demonized, and it will eventually, I think, face being banned in Britain. I know it's banned in some Arab countries. And I still haven't got the full picture of that. But quite often, groups and countries and individuals aren't picked out at random. There is a more hidden agenda behind it. So, you know, we have to be very wary and watchful for these signs.
I think the suicide bombings in Baghdad and London and 9/11, are they justified as jihad? I mean, would we say that that's, we're fighting for Islam if the Muslims committed them?
Well, you know, that question is getting into the realms of a scholar's remit. And Islamically, I'm only 2 years old, so I do have my own opinions, but I think it would be foolish of me to go down that route, because I'd probably make an error and a mistake. And the majority of us are all new Muslims, and I think that we would benefit more if that type of question were directed at a scholar.
In New Zealand, we're unique in that there is no real inherent Muslim culture. I know, alhamdulillah, that the Fijian people have been here for quite a long time. But as a revert myself as well, can you sort of offer any suggestions as to how the different cultures and nationalities can come together in New Zealand and unify And especially at the moment, you know, they say that the a disability is an opportunity. And as you say, in the last 3 weeks, what has been happening, this is a really big opportunity for New Zealand Muslims, whether they're converts or whatever, to educate our fellow New Zealanders about Islam. So have you got any suggestions about how we can all come together from different backgrounds, different cultures, different countries, to sort of, you know, go forward in that area?
I was at a great event in Christchurch. It was a sisters only event, and many different nationalities came together there, and it was wonderful. And we had entertainment from different sections of the community, and it really was very unifying. And I think that more events like that, events like this, food is a great unifier. I was at a fantastic event last year where everybody came with one of their national dishes, and you know, there were more than 25 different countries represented, and you know, I ate for Britain, and mercifully for them, I didn't bring any food from Britain, because let's face it, I think Chirac was right when he said that, when he criticised English cuisine. But events like that, events like this, are great unifiers. I have visited two schools today, one here. There are 25 different nationalities in this school alone, which is great. And our children are a common bond, and maybe through the schools, through the Muslim schools, parents can organise events and get together as well. Because let's face it, if we can't integrate among ourselves, we've got no chance of integrating in the wider world.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum salam.
Well, we welcome you in New Zealand.
Thank you.
And inshallah, there will be a lot of benefit actually while you're here, inshallah, and we hope you're coming back again. Like you just mentioned us, that we write letter to the editors and also talk on talk back. Well, myself, of course, yesterday I was on 1ZB yesterday, and I gave a good talk about Winston Peter and a few things. And also I did mention people, okay, why don't you people come to the Gandhi Hall on Saturday 7 o'clock and ask yourself question to the sister who just came from England. I did introduce yourself on the 1ZB. And also today in Masjid Umar, which is Mount Roskill, there is a herald people came and they took our interview. And inshallah, you see probably my picture or somebody else's photo will come tomorrow in Herald. And we did actually give a good talk about, okay, the mosque is open for Winston Peter. He doesn't have to go anywhere else. Or rather, he get a cop job, you know. He can be follow Chinese and Indians and them and give them a hard time. The question actually I'm asking is this, that since you become a Muslim, alhamdulillah, and what actually happened when the... You know, when became you Muslim, and you used to be a journalist for the newspaper. What happened after that? What obviously they got much of a shock and surprise, and probably you must go into some difficulties.
When I went into Afghanistan, I was the chief reporter of the Sunday Express, and in fact, I must tell you this little story. My publisher, Richard Desmond, a Jewish businessman, very hard-nosed, astute businessman, he sent his right-hand man to go and negotiate directly with the Taliban for my release. And he said, 1 million, 2 million, whatever it takes, just bring her back. And the editorial director went out to Islamabad and knocked on the door of the Taliban embassy. And he was with an Urdu-speaking lawyer, and she kept this man right on matters of etiquette. And they were very impressed that they had bothered to go directly to the embassy, because the Taliban had been ostracized by the entire world. Nobody was talking to them, and yet here some Westerners rolled up, knocked on the door, wanted to sit down and talk. And that evening, Paul Ashford, the editorial director, called the publisher, Richard Desmond, and he said, I didn't get out the checkbook. And he went, oh, how much do they want? And he said, well, I don't think they want money, Richard, and I think it would have been the worst thing possible had I got out the checkbook and said, how much do you want? And he said, so what are they after? Arms? And he said, no, they just want to be treated with some respect. And Mr. Desmond said, are these people sick? And as a hard-nosed businessman, he couldn't understand why they wouldn't have been interested in money. But he and the team worked round the clock to get me out of that situation. And I've forgotten what the question was now.
Oh, right, yes,
that was just to show how valuable the company, or how they valued me. And I left a few months later because I wanted to go back to Afghanistan. And they said, we can't go through the same again, you'll be targeted. And we parted on friendly terms, and I still, even now, do occasional work for them. And then I moved into television and radio and expanded my brief. And now I'm working for the Islam Channel. I've got a couple of brochures here for anybody who is interested. And I have to say at this point that my views that I've expressed tonight aren't aren't necessarily those of the Islam Channel. Just thought I'd get that one in. But so now I'm working in an Islamic atmosphere with Muslims, and we're doing a lot of dawah work, and I have a political program, and we're having really good fun entertaining and informing and motivating Muslims and non-Muslims alike. And we even had, we've had a few people revert as a result of watching the Islam Channel, and we even had one sister who took her shahada down the telephone live on TV, the first high-tech shahada, and it was brilliant. So, but I still do keep in and still work for the old Fleet Street crowd when they want me.
باعتبارك أنت إعلامية قديمة، ما سر الحملة التي يقوم بها الإعلام الغربي على الإسلام؟ هذا أولا. وهل تعتقدين أن هذا الإعلام موجه من جهات أخرى؟ ثم ما هي أفضل السبل لأن تصبح العلاقة بين المسلمين بخاصة في بلاد الغرب وبين الإعلام الغربي تصبح العلاقة جيدة؟ وشكرا.
Brother is Dr. Zaid Omar Mustafa. He's a professor in King Ibn Saud University in Islamic Studies. He preferred to express himself in Arabic. His question is that what is the secret behind this vicious campaign against Islam? Do you think that it is intentionally directed by governments? And the third part of the question is what methods you would suggest to create an atmosphere of communication, positive communication between Muslims and between the mass media that creates this kind of vicious campaigns? Thank you.
Yes, there is a campaign against Islam, and of course it is coming down from governments, because a lot of powerful people are in government, and the reason why they fear Islam so much, one of the reasons is, look at tonight. What were we all doing a few years ago? We were probably all sold on the Western excesses, smoking, alcohol, goodness knows what else, TV. Well, I work for the Islam Channel, so we'll not go too far down that route. But look what's happened to the reverts. In Britain alone, there are 14,000 reverts to Islam since 9/11. The Quran since 9/11 has become the best-selling book in the world. More people are converting to Islam than any other faith in the world. And the vast majority of those converts, reverts, are women. And it has the governments scared. Why? Because we don't need grand churches or men with pointy hats and crooks to bow down to pray to God and use as a conduit. And we don't have to empty our pockets and throw them into collecting tins. If we want to create a mosque, we do that. We can draw a line in the sand, and that is our mosque. We don't drink. Now, America is the greatest superpower in the world, the largest army in the world, the greatest arsenal in the world. And it introduced prohibition, banned alcohol in the 1920s, and the greatest superpower in the world couldn't stop people drinking. How many people in here drink? I'd like to bet zero. Why? Why don't we drink? Because we fear America? Because we can't afford it? Because we're saving up for something? No, because we fear no one but Allah. And that is what the governments, the men in power, are afraid of. They fear our fear of Allah. And to illustrate how great this fear is, I'll tell a very simple story. There is a brother called Martin Mbanga. He was one of the Guantanamo Bay detainees. And he was released a few months ago. And he finally got to see his family, and he said to his sister, "I got letters from you, but phrases were blacked out. And so I couldn't understand what it was that you had said." And he showed her the letters, and everything that had been blacked out was, "Inshallah, may Allah protect you. God willing." Any reference at all to God and Allah was blacked out. That is how they fear us. It wasn't a subversive message. You know, the file is in the cake under the... Nothing like that. Allah. They fear Allah. Not in the way we do. But this is why they have gone to war on Islam. Because they can't control us in the way that they would like to. And that is what it is all about. You have mentioned the demonization of Pakistanis and Hizbut Tahrir. Anything from your understanding of current politics about Syria? It's the relationship Syria and America has, it's schizophrenic. America keeps saying that Syria is in the axis of evil, and then it's knocking on the back door saying, "Take this prisoner and torture him and get whatever information you can." And Syria's going, "Yes, of course, we'll do that." And they take him away. Then we're told that American troops are going into Syria when they're patrolling the borders of Iraq, and they're saying that Syria is providing all these foreign fighters. I know that that's untrue, and I know that that's propaganda, but Syria seems prepared to put up with this. It's a really bizarre relationship. It's an abusive relationship, and Syria is in some sort of denial. It's acting like a battered wife. It's keeping silent, and it's been humiliated, and yet it has been craven in its desire to please America. And it's very, very bizarre. But I do not think for one moment that America's next military adventure will involve Syria. And, you know, maybe somebody else in here can explain the relationship better, or maybe they've got a better insight, but it's certainly very schizophrenic.
Right. Can you not tell us what happened?
Take more pictures of the dead.
Yep. Why not?
What?
Don't shoot people? They did that to us.
Yeah, well, you invited their country. That might explain something.
Hey, don't even say
no. No.
Hey, you know where we're going right now? We're going to pay for Iraqis right now. We're boosting the Iraqi economy right now. So you know, that's what we're doing.
Sir, boosting their economy?
Get out of here.
Step on that side.
These are images from the war in Iraq. Images our media and governments would prefer you didn't see.
That's many family lives here. Many Iraqi family lives here.
The war is taking a terrible toll on the entire population. The Lancet reported that up to 100,000 Iraqis have been killed and many more wounded, including thousands more who've lost limbs.
His wife and two sons, and what remained for him. Just this boy, he got amputation of his foot.
Men, women and children have been kidnapped, while entire communities have been displaced. Now, nearly 2 years on, the security situation grows worse by the day. In addition, thousands more casualties have been inflicted in the city of Fallujah as a result of two massive attacks. It appears that the politicians and generals are no longer accountable to the mainstream media, who are now exclusively embedded with the British and American forces. Since Al Jazeera has been banned and freelance journalists are being killed and kidnapped, almost no one is left to report the war independently. This has effectively turned the casualties into the silent victims of the war. What happens when a health system is utterly devastated by war and sanctions? How can it cope without medicines, anesthetics, electricity, surgical equipment, and qualified medical staff? People arrive at their local hospitals desperate for help, only to find the doctors despairing over the lack of the most basic facilities. For example, the main prosthetics clinic in Baghdad suffered minor bomb damage during the assault on Baghdad last year and was stripped bare by looters in the chaotic aftermath. Today, nearly 2 years on, medics struggle to cope with the flow of amputees and find themselves having to improvise treatments on a daily basis. One doctor explains how he had to borrow his father's hammer to carry out simple repairs on artificial limbs. Meanwhile, promises of assistance from occupying forces have largely failed to materialize. 18 months ago, the director of the prosthetics clinic was approached by the U.S. Army and CPA to draw up a list of his urgent medical requirements. As of today, he has yet to receive so much as a reply.
So that's 1 year after the sanctions are finished.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I hope I have some material for outside, some, yeah.
So what do you tell them to the parents of these children?
We tell them should we wait.
And what of the casualties? 4-year-old Ali, who had been maimed in a cluster bomb attack, was found by journalists Garib and Lee Gordon in a Fallujah hospital last April. They managed to get him transferred to Baghdad, where he underwent surgery to save his life. Tragically, he lost his left leg and arm and suffered damage to his genitalia. Another case is 11-year-old Zainab, who was severely injured in a cluster bomb attack in Basra. The blast killed 17 members of her family and blew off her right leg. She was flown to the UK to be fitted with a prosthetic limb. Despite the kindness shown to her and considerable media, political and celebrity exposure, she will soon be returning to Iraq to face life without similar levels of attention and medical treatment.
I think we need to address some of the pain, some of the suffering we've caused in Iraq, the people who have been injured, the people who have seen their livelihoods destroyed. And that's why I think we need to accept a very important priority for humanitarian help. I find it particularly difficult that there should be 2,000 children like you who've lost limbs and for whom there's not proper hospital provision inside Iraq. That's something that Britain could do, and that's something Britain ought to do.
As yet, there are no plans for establishing a clinic in Iraq to provide care for Zainab and the thousands of other victims like her. These are just a few glimpses of the tragedies that unfold on a daily basis in Iraq. Unless we increase our efforts to report on the plight of these people and urge governments and NGOs to transfer aid to them as soon as possible, many more stories will be left untold and voices unheard.